We're looking now at some recent fires caused by spontaneous combustion. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's the process of catching fire as a result of heat generated by internal chemical action, not from a spark, not from a flame. It can happen in a pile of compost. It can happen to a bunch of oil rigs heaped in a corner. Do you work with chemicals and take certain precautions to make sure the materials you use don't spontaneously combust? Has something ever caught fire in your home with no apparent reason? What happened? We're at 800-642-1234. BJ DeMa is fire chief of the Waupun Fire Department. Chief DeMa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate.
Well, two recent fires that happened in your community, fire officials determined were the result of spontaneous combustion. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, we had an incident recently. Individual had been doing a staining project of some wood in a workshop area, and we were called the following morning to smoke that had filled the area. As we investigated it, we ended up determining that some stain rags that were left balled up on the workbench over time spontaneously combusted and ended up burning a section of the workbench away. The second incident actually dealt with clothes that had recently come out of a dryer. They were dumped in a pile on top of a metal workbench, and same situation, about a half hour later, the pile had started burning and was fortunately contained by an automatic sprinkler system within the building.
Do we understand how these types of fires happen? How do fires start without a spark or a heat source?
Yeah, so spontaneous combustion is going to happen one of two ways. It's either going to happen due to a biological process, and that typically deals with more of your organic materials, or it can happen due to oxidation, which is a chemical reaction that ends up creating heat. And if the material is in a pile, that pile cannot dissipate any of that heat. So it continues to generate until it reaches a point that it starts burning.
How much of a concern should this kind of accident be for people? How often do objects burst into flames?
If you look at data from the National Fire Protection Association, they say there's over 14,000 fires annually that start from spontaneous combustion. And if I had to venture a guess, that number may be a bit low. So it is something that is more common than folks maybe realize, but there are many things that people can do to be safe. As we talk about one of our instances, stain rags, making sure those are going in a metal container with a tight-fitting lid is very important. When we talk about clothes, making sure it's not left in a pile. If you're going to dump them out, kind of spread them out, a shorter pile. The thing people tend to forget is, especially with some of your oils, if you use a rag to wipe those up, even though they go to the laundry to be cleaned, it doesn't get rid of all the oils. So that's some of the issues that we'll see with clothes left in a pile. That oil can start that process again when it's in a bigger pile.
Well, as we start to wrap up here, are there any kinds of safety precautions that farmers need to take? Are hay piles an issue?
Hay, the biggest thing with hay is making sure that, again, it's dry when it's baled. I think most fire departments can say they've had a call through the years that it was a result of hot hay within a, whether it's in the mow or if they're rolled up. Again, just the concept of it cannot release heat and it'll start burning.
Well, Chief DeMa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking with BJ DeMa. He's fire chief of the Waupun Fire Department. We've been talking about fires caused by spontaneous combustion and a recent string of them in the Fond du Lac area. Now we have U.S. Senator Ron Johnson with us here on the morning show. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill are dealing with a number of thorny national and foreign policy issues ahead of their target adjournment in December. And U.S. Senator Ron Johnson chairs the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Senator Johnson, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Morning, Kate. How are you doing?
Doing well. Let's start with Russia. Last month, you were denied a visa to enter Russia as part of a bipartisan delegation. And meanwhile, President Trump was seeking to readmit Russia into the G7, the group of seven industrialized nations. What should be our country's foreign policy goals right now with Russia?
Well, first of all, we need to recognize what a tragedy of historic proportions it has been that Vladimir Putin has put Russia and its government and its people on this path. Just think how different the world would look, you know, really how more successful Russia would be if they had fully integrated into the Western economies, embraced, you know, true democracy, pluralism. Now the world would be a much better place. But Vladimir Putin is, hungry on power, and the way he maintains his power is through destabilizing the former Soviet nations and other nations in the Soviet Union sphere of influence so that they are not economically successful. That is how he maintains his power. The worst thing for him is if Russians would see a different economic system work better than what theirs is performing right now.
What were you?
To understand exactly who he is and the aggressions he is fomenting around certainly the region and the world.
What were you trying to accomplish to be able to go to Russia in August?
Well, as chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on European Relations, as part of the Foreign Relations Committee, Ambassador Huntsman, when he took over that post, reached out to me and has been trying to set up congressional to parliamentary exchanges so we can start the dialogue. You know, at some point in time, Putin will be out of power. And you know, it is good to have dialogue. It's good to understand each other's perspectives. So we tried this in December 2017. They played games that wouldn't allow my ranking member, Senator Jean Shaheen, her entry in there. I was allowed into Moscow in June or July of 2018. And then I was going to go with another bipartisan delegation, and they continue this game playing. I don't see why they think there's any benefit to that whatsoever. You know, I'm always going to speak the truth. I've been speaking honestly about Russia even when they did let me in. So, again, I call it a petty affront. They're just playing games.
Well, after federal investigations found Russia meddling in the 2016 elections, do you see a need for our government to boost election security ahead of 2020?
Well, first of all, we need to realize that both under the Obama administration and under the current administration, DHS, who is primarily tasked with problem, trying to deal with that, has actually done a pretty good job. And it's primarily about, first of all, highlighting it. Our first line of defense on any kind of cyber attack is just awareness of it. And so they've certainly made state and different election officials aware of this. They've gone through a fair amount of security clearances so that we can transfer classified information to election officials. I think people have hardened their firewalls to prevent Russian interference. But people need to understand it's almost impossible to change vote tallies other than through election fraud. In terms of election files, to me, that's probably the greatest risk to our election system. And then you just have the whole social media interference. That's been going on forever. It's just a different means now. I mean, Russia has always tried to interfere in our internal politics. That'll continue to go on. I think social media companies have done a pretty good job of taking down some of the sites they developed. When you do that, that really moves an awful lot of the work they've have done in terms of developing the number of people on those sites. So we certainly are attacking and taking it seriously.
Let's pause right there. Don't go anywhere. Talking national news with U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, international news as well. Your thoughts. What do you think should be our country's foreign policy goals with Russia, with China? Join in. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We have U.S. Senator Ron Johnson on the line with us here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about a number of national and international policy issues with your questions front and center at 800-642-1234. What do you think should be our country's foreign policy goals with Russia, with China? And what do you make of Iran? What are you watching for when it comes to our economy here in the U.S.? What should Senator Johnson know as lawmakers weigh legislation on Capitol Hill? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org, and Senator Johnson stays with us. Let's look at Iran, tensions rising between the U.S. as we saw the flashpoint this weekend. The Trump administration says Iran appears responsible for attacks on the Saudi Arabian oil field, while Iran is denying this. The president has really amped up the rhetoric, locked and loaded, he said in a tweet. What do we know about our response here? Is a military response warranted right now?
Well, first of all, I've looked at the intelligence. It's pretty simple. It's pretty basic. I'm not quite sure why we classify so much of this information. My guess is we'll completely verify it, and then I hope we make it public. So it is as clear as it is, I think, currently to me, I think, as it was to Secretary Pompeo, that Iran was responsible for this attack. And we need to understand exactly how Iran is threatening the region and, quite honestly, world stability here. The Iranian agreement was an awful deal. We pumped more than $100 billion into the economy and military of the world's greatest state sponsor, terror. They haven't backed off. I mean, I know President Obama's trying to change their behavior. It's changed. It's changed for the worse. So Iran is a growing threat. It's a growing menace. And we do need to stop them before they actually become a nuclear power.
So is it military force against Iran? Is it looking at its proxies in Iraq or Yemen? Or is it some kind of combination or basically no retaliatory attacks? Where do you fall down on that?
I think you need to keep all options on the table. I do not believe we can allow Iran to become a nuclear power. Their behavior is so egregious, it is so menacing, that they are like almost the last power in the world that I'd want to see have nuclear weapons. So that's something we have to deny them, and that may require military action.
Let's move on to China here for a moment. You disagree with President Trump's trade war as an effective strategy. You've said trade wars, nobody wins. There is no winning a trade war. So what should our country be doing differently to address your concerns with China?
Well, first of all, as many farmers and manufacturers in Wisconsin who are being hurt by the trade war, we all agree with what President Trump is trying to do. China is the abuser of the world trading regime. They're not following the rules. They're stealing hundreds of billions of dollars of our intellectual property and use that intellectual property to outcompete us in some areas, leapfrog ahead of us in technologically in some cases. So I think from my standpoint, my disagreement is, engaging in trade wars across the world, what we should be doing, and first thing we should do is ratify the USMCA. I'm calling on Wisconsin's Democratic congressional delegation to put pressure on Nancy Pelosi to bring up USMCA so we can ratify that one, put that behind us. If we could be a united front against China demanding that they stop stealing our intellectual property and comply with the World Trading Organization rules, that'd probably be, from my standpoint, the best approach. I don't believe anybody wins a trade war. I do believe that China is paying the highest price. It is definitely affecting their economy far more than it is ours. So from that standpoint, if it's a relative thing, yeah, we're winning that one, but it still harms our economy. It creates instability. So again, the problem is that China has a different type of political system, and they can withstand the pain politically probably longer than we can.
Well, speaking of the economy, there's new Moody's Analytics numbers out saying that this trade war is causing 300,000 fewer jobs being created in the U.S. By year end, it could be 450,000. Are you seeing a tipping point in this trade war?
Well, first of all, we have record low unemployment just overall, but also if we're not at record lows, we're near record lows unemployment in the African American community, the Hispanic community. So we still have a very strong economy. My concern is the uncertainty, the instability, and the metric I'm looking at is the growth in business investment, which was sky high after President Trump stopped adding to a regulatory burden, signed a more competitive tax system. The instability of the trade war has shaken people's confidence, and we actually had a negative growth in business investment. That's really what you need for long-term economic growth. So that's, to me, the alarm bell that's going off that I know the Trump administration is aware of. again, it is hard to get China into compliance. This president is very serious about it. I appreciate the fact that he's very serious about making China comply. This is a high-stakes poker game here, basically. Who's going to blink first? Again, China is being harmed far more than the American economy, but we're not exactly going unscathed.
Are Wisconsin farmers running out of patience?
Probably. They're nearing their end of patience. But, again, I have been very surprised at how patient not only Wisconsin farmers but also manufacturers have been, because they understand that we have not been treated fairly. That we have been generous, magnanimous in terms of opening up our markets to the world, and we've been taken advantage of, and they actually support President Trump's goal of hopefully a zero-tariff world, but also free, fair, and reciprocal trade.
Talking with U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, he's a Republican representing Wisconsin. Your questions, your insights as well at 800-642-1234. What are you watching when it comes to the economy? What should Senator Johnson know as lawmakers weigh legislation? What questions do you have for the senator? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Senator, over the weekend, you voiced concerns that President Trump banning flavored e-cigarettes could be an overreaction. How should the government address vaping, which is being blamed for 6 deaths? We're seeing hundreds of lung injuries in dozens of states and even here in Wisconsin.
Well, we first really need to investigate and find out what the cause of all these illnesses are. Initial reports are they're probably related to illegal vaping cartridges filled with THC, and those things are cut with oils, the lipids that don't completely combust, and that's what's causing the problem. I'm not aware yet of any evidence of a legal vaping product causing these illnesses. So we also need to understand how valuable vaping products are in terms of helping people quit an even more dangerous habit, which is cigarette smoking. The Royal Academy of Physicians in London years ago came out with a study said that vaping was 95% safer than cigarettes. So, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater here. We do need to take these illnesses seriously. But I think we're seeing is kind of a confluence of the effort to legalize marijuana, which has made THC oil, even in states where it's illegal, like Wisconsin, very available. We just had that case of the two brothers in Racine that were raided and filling up 3,000 cartridges a day at a tune of about $35 to $40. I mean, a highly profitable enterprise. I mean, that's a combination of, these vaping cartridges combined with the legalization of marijuana, making those oils available. So, we got a real problem on our hands here. I appreciate the FDA taking the addictive nature of vaping products, and we certainly should not be allowing marketing to young people and encouraging that. And I think the vaping industry has some explaining to do in terms of why so many teens are becoming addicted to a highly addictive product, which is nicotine.
Two Republican congressmen are heading out the door, as you know, as we look to Capitol Hill. Sean Duffy, Jim Sensenbrenner as well. Are you concerned about Republicans retaining those seats?
Not really. I think both of those cases had involved just health and just, Jim has served his country well for 40 years. I know his wife had a very serious stroke. He has a well-deserved retirement in front of him. So both of those districts have been very solidly Republican, particularly up in Jim's district, but up in the 7th, where Sean has done a great job of solidifying that district. So, again, they're not leaving Congress because of anything happening here in Washington, D.C. It's really to do with personal reasons.
So let's look at the federal government's next budget deadline, September 30th, end of the month. Do you see House Democrats and Senate Republicans working together to avoid another government shutdown?
Right now, the signs aren't very good. We're going to be taking a test vote on, I think we're going to bring up the defense appropriation bill. And what we're hearing, it's not very positive, that the Democrats do not really want a regular order type of appropriation process, which is why I've been pushing for months now the Prevent Government Shutdown Act, which I took up in front of my committee. Even though we don't have full jurisdiction, we crafted a bill that would be before our committee. We added on an automatic appropriation to do what we do in Wisconsin. If dysfunction in government doesn't allow for the passing of appropriation bills in Wisconsin. We don't shut down government. We just fund those government agencies at last year's levels.
Very quickly.
We do the same thing in the government, and I'm pushing that bill.
Very quickly, how long might we be for the next continuing resolution if we put this forward, push it forward?
Well, hopefully what we would do is pass the Preventing Government Shutdown Act, which we passed our committee 12-2. Every Democrat voted for it. The only two Republicans voted against it were the ones that had competing bills. So that's what I'm putting pressure on Senate leadership to bring up and pass. It's be pretty hard for any member to vote against a bill that would prevent government shutdowns.
Senator Johnson, thank you so much for your time.
Have a great day.
Ron Johnson is a Republican representing Wisconsin in the U.S. Senate. Just ahead, thousands of auto workers are on strike at General Motors. We'll look at labor issues and how the strike came to be and its impact in Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're talking about the United Auto Workers nationwide strike underway at General Motors. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Union officials allowed their contract to lapse over the weekend after both sides failed to agree on a new contract. The strike is affecting nearly 50,000 workers at dozens of manufacturing plants in nine states. Have you or do you work in the auto industry? What is your experience? What do you think state and federal lawmakers can do to strengthen the U.S. auto industry? And what questions do you have about the strike at GM? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in John Shelton. He is a professor of democracy and justice studies at UW-Green Bay. He teaches and researches the history and present-day issues of working people, unions, and jobs. John, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate. Good morning to you and all your listeners.
Well, give us the nuts and bolts of this disagreement between General Motors and the UAW. What is going on here?
Yeah, so, you know, your listeners may be hearing a little bit about this and may just, you know, kind of seem like a ordinary labor conflict if there is such a thing. But really, I would encourage everyone to think about this as a conflict over the future of economic security for working people in this country. So General Motors plant is looking for, the General Motors company is looking for concessions from workers. They want them to pay more for their health care, for instance, and they want more flexibility in terms of production. The workers, as you mentioned, about 49,000 of them on strike today, are really pushing for the company to walk back some of the things that they've done over the past couple of years. So one of those things is a tiered working system. So this was a really common thing for companies to do in the wake of the economic crisis. Your listeners in Wisconsin here might remember that Mercury Marine set up a two-tiered working system. Kohler set up a two-tiered working system. And what that means is that workers who have already been there for a while would have access to a different set of wages and different set of benefits. And new hires would have basically come in at a second tier where they would have much less economic security in some cases, lower wages, worse benefits. And at GM, there's also this category of workers called temps who have even fewer,
protections.
Workplace rights than that, protections than that, right? So they can be, basically let go almost, on a whim. And the other thing is the workers are also looking for GM to bring back production to places where it's cut production. So,
like Lordstown, Ohio.
Exactly, like in Lordstown, which was this sort of symbol of working class prosperity back in the 60s and 70s. Dan Kaufman, who wrote a great, excellent piece about this for The New Yorker, goes into sort of what it meant to close that down. So they're asking to bring production back to those places. So when you think about the conflict that way, it's there's a pretty big line in the sand between these two sides over what this is going to look like.
So this is the first United Auto Workers strike since 2007. How massive is this strike compared to what we've seen in recent history?
It's big. It's every General Motors plant. So as you said, it's in states across the country. There are workers out on strike, in just about every region, the Midwest, the South. So it's going to affect a lot of those communities.
Did we have any indication that the strike was coming? Were there divides between the UAW and GM that have really gone too deep here?
Well, you know, I don't know what I don't know that any conflict is insurmountable. But, you know, I think this has been brewing for a while, you know, and I think one of the things that working people are looking at is the profitability of GM, right? So, you know, in the past, there have been times when, you know, automakers have looked for concessions from workers. And, you know, of course, those the classic case of that is, you know, during the economic crisis back in, you know, 2008, where, you know, pretty much every auto union made concessions to save jobs. This isn't the case now. You know, I'm not an expert on the auto industry by any means. But, you know, one statistic I saw said that GM has made like $35 billion over the past 3 years in North America alone. So I think what the workers are saying is, you know, we should put some of those profits into making sure that we have sustainable livelihoods here. And, you know, I would also connect this to the bigger political picture in this country. I mean, you know, as somebody who studies this history, you know, I think there for politicians in both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, if they're not paying attention to how to create sustainable livelihoods for working people, they are, you know, not going to be able to win elections. They're not going to be able to, you know, change the direction of the country in the way that they might want to change it. It's really clear that there is sort of a blue collar uprising, I think, in both parties, really. And, you know, this strike, I think, really fits into that.
Talking with John Shelton, he is a professor of democracy and justice studies at UW Green Bay. What do you think state and federal lawmakers can do to strengthen our country's auto industry? What questions do you have about the strike going on at General Motors? Join in with your questions, your observations, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. John, the number of strikes with 1,000 workers or more has risen to its highest level since the 1980s. Put this into context for us. What does it mean when we have more striking workers?
Well, you know, as I was saying before, I think the issue of economic security for working people is paramount in the United States right now. It's a problem that we probably don't pay enough attention to, but, you know, certainly, you know, again, there's been, like I said, uprisings in both parties against this. So, you know, your listeners are probably aware that in the 2016 election, the many of the forces that were supporting Trump were sort of desperation votes, hoping to save blue collar jobs. You know, the Carrier factory in Indiana that got a lot of attention. But the same is happening in the Democratic Party. So, you know, you look at some of the insurgent forces there, and I look at Bernie Sanders, for example, who has made really enhancing workers' rights a key part of, you know, his sort of insurgency against the so-called Democratic establishment, right? Calling for massive changes like sectoral bargaining, ensuring people have a right to a job. So in a case like General Motors, workers could only be fired if they, you know, did something wrong. And so, you know, I think, you know, he's a politician, but he's sort of channeling some of these forces. So to go back to last year, of course, many of your listeners know that some of those really big strikes were in public education. They were in the public sector. But now we're seeing this in the private sector, too. And, you know, I'm not sure that necessarily we can argue that the teacher strikes were necessarily, you know, directly responsible for these private sector strikes, but I think they're sort of riding the same forces, right? So, like, you know, as your listeners know, we had the Harley-Davidson conflict earlier this year, and then certainly, you know, the strike with the UAW, I think, fits into that.
A number of states, Wisconsin among them, have passed right-to-work legislation, and the Supreme Court, the Janus decision, sided against unions. Do you think unions have the strength that they once did?
Well, I think we're at a moment that is extremely interesting. So, you know, I study labor history, and, you know, there since really about the 1980s, when you had, you know, that last year we had an enormous number of strikes that you were referring to. That was actually 1986. There's been these sort of constant discussions of, you know, is labor going to be revitalized? Can labor be revitalized? And the short answer to that is, you know, labor membership has continued to decline, particularly in the private sector. I think labor membership now is, you know, the percentage of workers covered by collective bargain contracts is, you know, 6-7%, something like that. And, you know, it's, as you mentioned, the Janus case, we haven't quite seen the results yet. And I think that's in part because a lot of public sector unions were prepared for, you know, to organize and make sure that people didn't leave unions. But, you know, certainly the Janus case was something that's going to make things more difficult for public employee unions. But I think all of those things, again, are part of the real efforts by, you know, employers in the United States. And these have been ongoing efforts since about the 1940s. I'm not making this up. You can easily find the evidence for this, to diminish the number of workers who are protected by unions, right? Because it decreases their having union representation, decreases employer flexibility, makes it more difficult to cut costs. And so, you know, I think we are at a moment where the kind of militance we're seeing from workers could be the beginning of, you know, a labor resurgence. And particularly if it's mobilized by politicians. I don't want to talk too much about, you know, Bernie Sanders, obviously, but, you know, I think his, you know, proposal for revitalizing labor is probably the most robust proposal for revitalizing labor that we've seen in decades.
Well, let's pause right there and bring in Dave and Nina with thoughts. Dave, hi.
Hi. I've been around a long time, worked a lot of different jobs, and then what I've seen as far as this two-tiered pay scale thing, it's rampant across the country, but it's more to, a lot of this is more to feed the corporate gang members at the top, the fat cats. And when you find out all too often when strikes are settled and people go on strike, if you look deep into things, or if the workers come out on the short end, the corporate compensation at the top is just so outrageous right now for executives, and that's kept on the hush-hush. But, I mean, if you look at some of these GM corporate people at the top, it would blow your mind, their compensation packages. And that's what it probably all comes down to, is the fat cat at the top wanting to get fatter, you know, off the backs of the workers.
Dave, thank you for that call. And when we come back, John, let's address income inequality, wages, and wage stagnation, another issue. We're talking about this nationwide strike by the UAW, the United Auto Workers. What this means for labor unions, as we see nearly 50,000 workers on the picket line. John Shelton is a democracy and justice studies professor at UW Green Bay. How have you seen the auto industry change in your area? Are you a member of a union? Has that impacted your ability to negotiate contracts? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the UAW strike here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kahn. Thanks for being here. The strike is the first against General Motors since a two-day walkout in 2007. On Saturday, union officials allowed their contract to lapse. Some of the major sticking points, as we've been talking about, include pay raises demanded by workers, the cost of health insurance, another one. GM made about $8 billion in profits last year. What questions do you have about the GM strike? Have you seen the auto industry change in your area? Are you a member of a union? How has that influenced your ability to negotiate contracts? Join in on this labor conversation at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. John Shelton stays with us. He studies unions through history as a professor of democracy and justice studies at UW Green Bay. John, as the caller was saying there, a lot of concern around income inequality, that executives get paid way too much than the rank and file worker. What is the impact of income inequality and wage stagnation as we see these walkouts?
Sure. And, you know, I'd like to thank Dave for calling in. That was his name, right, Dave?
Mm-hmm.
You can prove empirically some of the things Dave was talking about. So the average, you know, CEO now makes about 15 of the top 350 companies makes about $15 million, which is like 270 times what the average worker makes. Contrast that to like the late 70s when it was about 30 times. So, it, you know, what he was talking about is empirically true. And I think for working people, you know, I don't think most working people in the United States really care that much if the executives at their corporations that where they work are well paid, right? I mean, I think that, you know, we have a kind of longstanding sense in the United States that people deserve to be compensated for their labor. But I think when it's come at the expense of good working class jobs, when it's come at the expense of the economic security, I think that's where people, you know, like the caller are really angry about it. And they're taking action because they want to see something done about it. So again, the two-tiered system, which was sort of the premise of what he was talking about, is put into place specifically to try and lower labor costs, to have future workers make less than the workers who had already existed. And that leads to, you know, less business activity in the local community because those workers don't have enough money to spend in the community, or they have much less to spend in the community. And that's why the UAW and other, you know, recent labor conflicts we've seen in Wisconsin, I think I referenced this right at the beginning, but like at Kohler and at Mercury and Marine, the unions have fought really hard to try and end those practices because they understand what that means for their communities.
There was a Gallup poll last month showing 64% of Americans approve of unions, that public opinion support for unions is on the upswing. How has recent labor history influenced this at all in America's public opinion about unions?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a terrific question. And, you know, I think, again, we are seeing a sea change around that. So, there's a couple of interesting things to take out of that. I mean, number one is when you think about young people. So young people are the ones who are now in particular, you know, this is an understated thing in some of these, you know, blue collar jobs like the UAW and again, like Kohler, the tier two workers, they're younger people. Right. And also, you know, with other younger people who are, you know, even college graduates who are coming out of college and not finding the good jobs that, you know, maybe their parents had or their parents had at one time, they're much more amenable to doing something about it. They're much more amenable to organizing, right? And so some of the, you know, kinds of tropes about unions that, you know, they might have heard, you know, people might have heard 20 or 30 years ago about, you know, unions being corrupt or unions, you know, help protecting bad workers or something. They're not sticking anymore because people, you know, working people are seeing the reality of, you know, what economic conditions look like in this country.
Let's look at the overall impact that a strike can have on our economy. General Motors operates a dozen vehicle assembly factories in the U.S., 22 parts plants. What will strikes, you know, how will they impact our economy? What could happen here?
Well, the GM strike, you know, I'm not an economist, so I'll say that at the outset. But the GM strike, as you mentioned, it's communities all over the country, and you know, workers don't go on strike for fun. I think sometimes we forget that. I don't forget that, but you know, I think sometimes we as a society do. You know, it's a high risk action. There's a good chance that they, you know, aren't going to be paid for a while. And so not only does that affect them, but that affects everybody in their community, the local bars and restaurants, the grocery stores, you know, who maybe, you know, people are going to kind of cut back on their purchases. But, you know, I would say that there's also a risk to General Motors. Again, not an economist, so I don't want to, you know, go too far here. But, you know, they have been making big profits. And so shutting down production, it does actually provide some enormous leverage when you have that many workers. And I was reading something yesterday that on a business website that basically said that the financing for General Motors could be impacted by this. That, you know, if the strike lasted more than a couple of weeks, this could reduce the bond rating of General Motors to like junk bond status. So that could impact the company in the future. You know, so that's a significant risk. So there's lots of different ways that this is going to ripple throughout the economy, I think, particularly if it lasts a while.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with John Shelton, a professor of democracy and justice studies at UW Green Bay. We're looking at the strike by the United Auto Workers and labor across the country. Matt from Wausau emailed to say that Republicans have been putting pressure on unions for decades. Matt says that union membership is at an all-time low, and Matt expects that to continue to happen with President Trump in office. One thing I want to throw out here, John, is that, you know, looking at United Auto Workers, a large national organization, but it's a shadow of its former self. At the height, there were 1.5 million workers in the GM union. Now it's at about 430,000. Has it been easier at all for unions this size to survive, to organize, compared to yesteryear?
Well, certainly it's more, I mean, the easy answer to that question is, you know, certainly it's more difficult, right? And one of the big pressures that, or with the big, you know, pieces of leverage that a company like General Motors has is that they can ship production somewhere else. And so, you know, that decline in membership that you're talking about, it hasn't been something that's been just in the past few years, right? I mean, that's been the result of a series of pressures, really starting in the 1970s, you know, when you had, you know, economic crisis and corporations looking to downsize and move production elsewhere. But it's been helped by trade policy, right? So NAFTA, for example, again, not an economist, but, you know, I think the kind of general consensus is that NAFTA made it easier for companies like General Motors to move jobs overseas, and that gives them more leverage in negotiations. And, you know, the other thing I would say is that we, you know, if somebody is serious about having workers organize in the United States and have union representation, labor reform, there has to be labor law changes, right? So, like, even oftentimes when workers want to organize, and in some cases where the company wants workers to organize, so probably some of your listeners know about the UAW election at Volkswagen in Chattanooga, Tennessee. There's been a couple of them. It's perfectly legal for employers to hold, like, captive audience meetings where they basically, you know, sort of threaten workers that if they vote for the union that the company is going to move elsewhere. In fact, right before the most recent Volkswagen election, the governor of Tennessee was actually at one of these, the Republican governor of Tennessee, Bill Lee, was actually at one of these meetings sort of telling workers that they, you know, didn't need to organize. So, you know, I think something has to be done about labor law in order to, you know, really kind of facilitate the resurgence of these unions.
Very few seconds left, but what are you watching for as the GM and UAW negotiate, and what should we be watching for?
Well, I think, you know, who knows how long this is going to last, but I think one of the things you look for in strikes is you know, public opinion. And, you know, I think, again, the public opinion polls that you cited show that the vast majority of the American public is siding with workers. And, you know, that could be, you know, really a major piece of leverage for the workers here.
Well, John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a good day.
John Shelton is a professor of democracy and justice studies at UW Green Bay. Just ahead, the deputy state superintendent joins us to discuss Wisconsin student test scores and priorities in education. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.